Hi all, and welcome to our, wait for it, drum roll?
Nikki, can I get a drum roll? That's better.
Welcome to Ecolutions 100th episode. I know it mightn't seem like a big deal, but when Ecolutions started in 2019, it was only meant to be 5 episodes long. But we've kept it up because we think our environment and the climate crisis is the biggest and most important story of our times. One that needs all the attention it can get. And we're not going anywhere. Over the last 100 episodes, we've met thousands of young people who want to make a difference to our world. We've met them at rivers.
We got you, you're looking like a scoreboard.
On beaches.
It's such an amazing world and everyone should learn to appreciate it.
In their schools and underneath the night sky.
There we go, there is a soprano pipistrelle.
We've had presidents and writers, scientists and legends of natural history. And we couldn't let this series end without adding another amazing guest to our list. Today we'd like to welcome someone who went from being a star of our screens in Ireland to one of the most trusted broadcasters on science and nature across Europe and beyond. Liz Bonin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. Lovely to see you.
Lovely to see you too. I'm more than starstruck. I'm so, so delighted to be able to have a chat with you.
Stop it. You're too kind.
So I'm going to start with the first question. I'm feeling quite starstruck, but who of all the people you've met in the world of science has left you feeling in awe?
I mean, the first person that comes to mind is Sir David Attenborough. I've been very lucky to meet two women who really inspired me too in the sciences, Jane Goodall and Sylvia Earle, two tremendous women who you know, they never even thought about retiring. They're living out their passion. And I had the honour of meeting them. But Sir David, I remember when I first met him, I couldn't even speak because I'll never forget seeing on the television when I was growing up that iconic scene of him meeting the gorillas and then going off script and just talking passionately about, you know, the gorilla behaviour and how it was similar to us. It was like the animal you could really relate to in their mannerisms and their ways. And I was blown away and mesmerized. And then I finally got to meet him. I couldn't put a sentence together. And over the years, I've had the great privilege of getting to know him, working on different projects and having, you know, hosting an in-conversation event with him. I work with the Wildlife Trusts here. And so we've had events with him there and then as well. And I think the reason why he fills me with awe is not only because he's the most amazing storyteller, amazing conservationist, the most passionate person I know when it comes to wildlife. He is as lovely and generous with his time and kind and really connects with you when you speak to him. He totally appreciates that most of us are so in awe of him that we find it really hard to talk to him. So he leans in and he makes you feel comfortable. You know when they say, like, never meet your heroes? It's not true with David Attenborough. He still fills me with awe, not only because of what he's achieved for natural history storytelling. Like, he completely invented the genre that we know and love today. He also fills me with awe because he's just such an amazing human being. Like, he's everything you would want him to be and more.
That is so lovely. My heart feels touched by that. That is so, so gorgeous. We got to interview Jane Goodall as well. It was only a Zoom call, but that was a memorable one for us.
Still, what an honour that must have been. She was so amazing.
She was so lovely. Yeah. Okay, now on to the questions. As we like to do with our special guests, we've gathered questions for you from young people in schools across the country. These kids come from Taney Parish School in Dundrum, Clarehan National School in Tipperary, and Stepaside Educate Together, and a number of others. So let's get into them. Are you up for it, Liz?
Totally. Let's go for it.
So Nina asks,
when you were a kid, what kind of games did you play with light?
What I remember was not necessarily specific games, although hopscotch and all that nonsense, but it was more creating adventures in the wild. Before I moved to Ireland, I grew up in the mountains in the south of France, and we were very lucky to have a little wood beside our house. And my sister and I used to just go on these mad, like, beautiful adventures for a whole day. We were just off we'd go with our dogs and create stories about living on islands and just fabricating different storylines and imagining all different types of adventures surrounded by nature. That's the most enduring memory I have of being outside is just making up stories and playing out roles. You know, you were on a ship, or you had to save one of the dogs, or, you know, but we were surrounded by hedgehogs and snakes and insects and little birds. And just, oh, I just remember those times with joy.
That's so lovely. I wish that young people now could appreciate nature as much as maybe in the past.
I do feel really lucky that we didn't have computers and phones, and we experience what it feels like to be bored, which is actually quite a healthy experience, because then you make things out of more natural, more basic things that surround you. And so I think you just get more creative, and potentially you use your brain more too. But yeah.
I wish I didn't have a phone, because the amount
so
of time.
I wish I didn't have to use a phone.
So next we have a question from Robin from Taney Parish Primary School.
What age are you when you first were interested in nature?
And Sarah asks,
what first interested you to love nature?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know that there was a definite age, but when I look back on it now, what I know for sure is that from a very young age, being outside all the time, I'm also very lucky that my parents hail from the Caribbean. So they had family in the Caribbean that we would go back and see all the time. So not only was I outside all the time in France and in Ireland growing up, I was also running around barefoot with my cousins in the sea, snorkeling. I was surrounded by like magical things like little coral reefs. And so I think from a very young age, nature was working its magic on me without me realizing. So I fell in love with nature from the start. I just didn't realize it until I was older. And when it comes to the things I remember about what fascinated me, I remember being obsessed with little birds, because I could, with my young brain, I couldn't understand how something so beautiful and small and perfect was alive. And like, if I had a beating heart in my chest, how did something that tiny have a perfect tiny little beating heart? Or how did its tiny, tiny eye move in its socket? I was just really fascinated by living things and the perfection of them. I think that's why I went on to study biology and chemistry and then biochemistry, because I always had a fascination to understand how all living systems worked, down to the minutiae, down to the chemicals that were involved in, you know, all living processes. So it all started, yeah, from a really young age, observing wildlife.
Gorgeous again. So we have a crossover with this question from Eva and Nina.
When did you start doing all documentaries in the nature?
What made you want to start doing your interviews?
Actually, interestingly, the reason why I wanted to be in this industry is because I wanted to tell people about nature and tell people about the amazing scientists that were working to protect the planet. So in a way, it wasn't so much that I wanted to interview people. I was really eager to share what I was learning about the natural world with others, and to also show from examples of amazing humans doing great things with their lives, you know, really understanding how important it is to take care of nature so it can take care of us. I wanted to help showcase them to inspire others maybe to do the same way as I was inspired by David Attenborough and Sylvia Earle and Jane Goodall and all these amazing scientists. And even my science teachers and my science lecturers, I wanted to show other people, you know, what was possible. Yeah. So I was more interested to start off with to storytell, like to showcase the planet and the incredible humans working to protect it. And actually I found interviewing quite difficult to start with, because interviewing is a skill that you have to practice like everything else. And to get a scientist who's not used to being on camera to talk about their work without getting all nervous and kind of a bit formal, which I actually started doing when I was a presenter at the beginning as well, you know, you're just not used to it, is actually quite hard work. So it's not only that you have to ask the questions, it's you have to put them at ease so that you get across their heart and why their passion means so much to them, you know. But I quite liked the challenge. I just found it really difficult when I started.
Me too. When I started presenting this at 14, so like even when I did like little tiny little bits with Nikki, I found it a bit scary. So
you're a natural.
Oh,
so,
thank
like,
you.
So you've done your practice. You can tell, like, you've gotten used to it now, haven't you?
Yes, a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, I'd want to add 100 episodes. So Polly asks,
what's your favourite memory from presenting?
Oh, Polly, that's really difficult because I have been so lucky to see so many beautiful things. I have a lot of memories. A bunch come up in my head, so I might tell you about one or two or maybe three. Three have come up in my head. One of them is in the Galapagos, in a submersible, going a kilometer beneath the waves, into the depth of the darkness, beneath the waves for 7 hours. That flew by like it was 30 seconds. Honestly, it was the weirdest thing. And we followed the flanks of these volcanic islands. The majority of them are actually beneath the waves, right? So a kilometer down, you're just following the flanks of a volcano, and then you're exploring the depths with huge spotlights. And the biologist beside me, who was going, "That's new to science. That's new to science. We've never seen that before." It felt like being an astronaut of the Earth's inner space as opposed to outer space, and I will never forget it as long as I live. It was an extraordinary experience and very humbling and awe-inspiring. And you know, those types of experiences are the reason why I feel so passionately about sharing with people how majestic and miraculous this planet is and how lucky we are to live on it, you know. So yeah, there's that. And then there's one which was meeting an elephant eye to eye. She had come out of a forest with her herd. She wasn't the matriarch, but she was one of the sisters, one of the elder sisters who was looking after all the little babies. There were three babies underfoot, I think two or three. And they were coming out of a forest in the afternoon light. And we were behind this big, huge kind of tree. So she hadn't seen me. And I was sitting on top of a jeep. And the afternoon light was so perfect, it lit up her amber eyes. So they were like this dark orange, bright orange in this dark grey wrinkled face. And she came around the corner and she saw me and she was quite startled. So for a minute she looked really goofy because she was all like, "Whoa, what is this?" And then she got all defensive and fierce. Her eyes completely changed and she was like, "Do I need to attack this? Is this a threat to my family?" And then I looked down and gently looked back up at her, and then she realized I wasn't a threat. And for it might have been 5, 6 seconds of the most beautiful moment again of my life, where you're just exchanging a look with another animal and you're getting the cut of each other, you know? She figured out I wasn't a threat. And because my camera battery had run out, I wasn't behind a lens trying to take a picture of her. It was just me and her. And that stays with me. It's one of the most vivid wildlife images I have. Because I looked at her, you know, in the eyes. And one last one really quickly, because I'm obsessed with big cats. I studied tigers for my master's. I ended up going to the Russian Far East to study tigers with one of the most extraordinary scientists I've ever met, who taught me. We only ever saw the tigers on camera traps, but he taught me how to track tigers in the snow. And you never track them forward because you're going to end up meeting the tiger. You track them backwards to learn about their lives. So where they lay down, where they ate, did they make a kill? And it's like a detective story. You unravel the lives of these majestic Amur tigers by just looking at all their behaviors in the snow. That stayed with me forever as well. Yeah.
That's three amazing memories.
I mean, you only asked for one, Polly, but I gave you three.
Even better.
Our next question is from Ava, and she asks, what has been your favorite interview that you've done?
Ooh. These are all great questions, but to pick one out of all these things is a difficult one. What was the most enjoyable interview? Because David comes to mind, right? Because he very kindly came on a podcast that I did, and we had this really lovely, frank conversation about what needs to happen in the world to make us, you know, have a better chance of living sustainably. And it's obviously an honor to interview him. But actually, what came to mind is I recently made a series about the Caribbean, which is where, you know, my family come from. And we made sure that we would feature the people of the Caribbean as much as the animals, because more and more, you know, in conservation, we understand that it's about people and nature. We are nature. And for many, many hundreds of years, we considered ourselves separate from it. And it's partly why it's created so many problems, right, in the world, that we just think nature is separate from us and we can do whatever we want to it because it's ours to manipulate and to use. But actually, we are part of nature. So how do we learn to coexist? And oftentimes, whether it be indigenous communities or local communities who have stayed, somewhat more connected to nature because they live on small islands, or they live as fisher communities, so they're connected to the ebb and flow of nature and of how much fish they can, you know, they can harvest without running out of it. So you can learn a lot from people who have stayed more connected. And interviewing some of those people in the Caribbean was really beautiful. They're very warm and they live in community in a very real way, as is still the case in Ireland. In other parts of the world, you know, we are becoming more and more disconnected to each other and more siloed and individualized, right? And I think the people I met in the Caribbean reminded me about the beauty of we are a social species. We belong in community, working together. There's a real kindness and a generosity to the way that they treat visitors and how they share their personal stories and the challenges that they face. You know, the Caribbean is going through a really difficult time when it comes to conservation. And so some of the people I met there have stayed in my heart as well. They also, they kind of renewed my faith in humanity. Might sound a little bit dramatic, but it's really lovely to meet beautiful humans who remind you that we can be pretty extraordinary too, when at the moment the world is going through a funny time, you know. So yeah, they that was a really, really lovely experience to interview all of them, actually. So it's not just one person, but all of the people I met across Central America, and then St. Vincent and the Grenadines and Trinidad and Venezuela even. They were all just gorgeous, gorgeous people. Yeah.
Yeah, I think interviewing like the people that you don't usually see, like real life stories, is always so valuable.
You're right. You know, I do. Yeah, you're so right. And I think we look into that a lot as storytellers about how best to help inspire change and, you know, positive change for us and the planet. And we found that behavioral science tells you that personal human stories from just normal people telling you about what they do to try and make the world a better place is one of the most powerful tools we have for inspiring change, because people can relate and they can empathize, and then they feel like, oh, well, maybe if they're doing that, I can do that too. So yeah.
Yeah, yeah. 100%. So the next question is from Gracie, and she asks,
what's your favorite thing about being on TV?
Well, it's not the fame bit, I can tell you that much. I'm a very private person. But the best bit about being on TV for me is that it shouldn't be allowed that they pay me to go to these majestic places and discover nature, when as a biologist, that's all I want to do. So the best thing for me about being on TV is that I get to go on these incredible journeys. And like, for example, I spent 5 weeks in Botswana just observing different herds of elephants. So you kind of got to know them as a family, and you got to know their characters and how, oh, that one's really rowdy, that one's always causing trouble, or oh, she's really wise, she knows what she's doing, you know. And so to spend time in the company of animals like that, and to, I'm really obsessed with animal behavior. So to better understand the dynamics of a family group, or how orcas hunt, how they communicate, has been an absolute privilege, really. So that's the best bit about being on TV. I shouldn't have said out loud that I shouldn't be paid. I mean, you know, somebody's going to decide they don't need to pay me anymore because I can just go for free. But yeah, I can't believe my luck that somebody said, come on, we're going to get you to discover the world and tell other people about it, because that's the ultimate dream for me as a biologist. Yeah.
Gorgeous. Such a good opportunity for you. So this is a double question. It's from Oliver and Antonia.
How did it feel seeing so much climate change?
How do you feel about climate change?
Well, it's been tough. Given half the choice, I would rather be making programs about tigers and amazing animals. But very quickly into my career, along with many of my other, you know, my peers, other people working in television and natural history, we were seeing what was happening to the planet. And so then it was our job as, you know, broadcasters to communicate what was happening. And that means you do your research, you read the scientific papers, you interview all the scientists, and you fully understand the truth, because there's a lot of mistruths, unfortunately, about climate change and other things that are damaging the planet at the moment. And that was a hard journey for me, to really fully understand the extent to which we are damaging the planet. And by the way, climate change is interlinked with biodiversity loss and pollution. You know, it's about environmental and planetary damage. So, you know, you'd be learning about climate change, but then you'd go, oh my gosh, and that's impacting those species, and that's impacting the biodiversity of this forest. And that means that that ocean current isn't working, so the fish are really suffering. You know, there's a domino effect to how we're living on the planet that's pretty serious. So I found it really hard, but with help from community and from experts to know to sort of, you know, refill my batteries, I've learned that we have all the solutions at our fingertips, and that there are extraordinary people in all different sectors, whether it be science or even environmental law. So, you know, holding polluters to account. There's a group of economists that are looking to transform the economy so that we can take care of the planet as we take care of society. I've learned that, you know, as much as humans can be terrible in their behaviors and not see the wood for the trees about what we need to do to the planet, there are also as many incredible human beings who totally get it, who want to fix it, and who are working to that end.
So you just mentioned about like how people can be such a great part of the journey for combating climate change. So Harrison is asking,
in the past 5 years, has climate change awareness gone better or worse?
That's a really good question, because it brings into play, you know, how do we make sure people are aware, and are we making people aware in the right way? So I'd say my answer to that question would be, it's not so much that they're not as aware as 5 years ago, but I think as a communicator, I speak a lot to the public, and I see how much the public understands in certain topics. It is a tough topic to lean into. Life is quite hard at the moment, and, you know, we're financial issues, and there's a lot to be going on with your life. So it's easy to understand, look, that's a really tough thing to lean into, and it can be quite uncomfortable and difficult and complex and quite depressing. But I think that it's twofold for me. I don't think we're telling people enough about the real root causes of all of this. And I also don't think we're telling people, and by that I mean sort of the media as a whole in the news and like even politicians, I don't think we're taking care of each other well enough with this problem. It's not going to go away if we ignore it, but I absolutely believe that if we communicate it in a better way, it will not only help people to better understand it, but it will also inspire people to be part of the change. And I don't think the media at the moment and the news outlets are doing that properly. And it can get a bit complicated with respect to the reasons behind that. A lot of very, very rich people own media outlets, and they tend to control the news. Unfortunately, that's the truth. But that's where people like me and lots of other communicators can communicate things on podcasts like yours and on platforms like YouTube to make sure that we keep on reminding people what the truth is and also what all the solutions are. So as much as I've found it really hard to lean into the truth about climate change and biodiversity loss, I also feel really, really positive about what we can achieve. I mean, I guess it's why I continue to do my job, because I know the solutions are all there, and I've had the great pleasure of meeting incredible people who are already working towards that. So I think that we all have a responsibility, me included, in making sure that people are aware of the right aspects of climate change, not to be sort of overwhelmed with lots of facts. Like, we know that climate change is human caused. We can move on from that. Now we should be making people aware of how to play a part in being the change.
Yeah, promoting action. It's really good, and yeah, it's really important. Yeah. Okay, so this next question is actually really nice. It's from Nina.
What's your favorite part?
Nina, I love that question. And I love ferns. Ferns of all types, from the thicker fronds of hart's tongue ferns to the maidenhead ferns that are really, really delicate. I'm obsessed with ferns. I don't know why that is. I also really love, I think there's something really symbolic about when a fern begins to unfurl, you know, when it's all kind of wound in like this, and it's just perfection. I remember taking a picture of one of those in Galapagos when I was waiting to film. They were setting up the cameras and I was looking around, and I found this most perfect one that was my screensaver for years, because it was just so perfect, and it was the beginning of new life, and it was beautiful in itself, but it was going to grow and expand and become even more beautiful. And I just felt that was really symbolic for like what humans are capable of. Also, when it comes to flowers, there's a tiny, beautiful little pink five-petaled flower called Herb Robert that grows in many places, but I've seen it in the Burren. And the Burren is one of my favorite places in the whole world. The limestone pavements, it looks like a moonscape. But if you look closely, there's all these beautiful, colorful herbs and plants and flowers. And one of them is the Herb Robert. So whenever I go to the Burren, I look out for them. They're really pretty, really magical. They're part of the geranium family, I think. But yeah, they're really stunning.
Next time I'm in the Burn, I'll look out for them. They sound gorgeous.
Zoo.
Okay, so next we have a question from one of our Ecolution panelists, Arjun.
Hi, Liz. My name is Arjun Gambhir. I'm a former BT Young Scientist winner and a passionate young environmentalist. You have a strong background in science, and I really admire how you use that to inspire change. How do you balance the science with storytelling to help people truly care about the planet? Thank you.
That's a great question, Arjun, and congratulations. It's a really good question because I like to try and play a part in changing the perception that, oh gosh, here comes the science. How do we gently incorporate it into storytelling? You will all understand this, loving science yourselves, that for me, science isn't as weighty as it's been perceived to be. It is a beautiful, creative, fun, fascinating means of understanding the world around us. And really, if you care about the world around you, if you're curious about anything, whether it be tech or nature or the stars, you're a scientist. It's not just a discipline. You know, that old school kind of perception of, you know, boffins in white coats and glasses. It's nothing like that. It's actually just being human. I think science, yes, you have to learn it in school and university, but it's really a way of being, right? A way of understanding the world around you. So as a storyteller, I work hard to try and just combine it in a very unapologetic and a much more natural way than perhaps we have done in the past. I think that will serve everyone better as well. So you don't think, oh gosh, it's really hard. It's not for me. So it's a lot to do with how you tell stories. It's a lot to do with practicing. I was rubbish as a presenter when I started. I was really formal. I thought I had to be really, get all my words right. And over the years, I've realized the more natural, the more conversational you are, the more you connect to an audience. And that's the same whether you're describing how trees transpire water and release it as water vapor into the canopy of the Amazon, or whether you're telling your friend what you had for your tea. You know what I mean? And so I think if we all work as scientists to kind of change that narrative, change that perception, unapologetically just tell the stories you want to tell in as passionate a way as possible, then we're going in the right direction.
Okay. This is something that I would love the answer to, but Sarah is asking,
what is your top tip for people to do to help the environment?
That's a great question. These questions are really good. That top tip has changed over the years. I've thought long and hard. I will say very quickly as well that a lot of the onus has been put on us as consumers. Like, we must find all the solutions, you know, change our plastic use, don't go on holidays, really kind of crank down on sort of how we are damaging the planet. And what I've learned over the past few years especially is there's all sorts of trustworthy facts about the biggest contributors to climate change, the biggest contributors to plastic pollution. And they all happen to be, surprise, surprise, fossil fuel industry related, big industries. So whether it's fossil fuel extraction itself that contributes by a vast majority to climate change is fossil fuel burning, or petrochemical companies who continue to make new plastic as they encourage us to clean up the beaches. I mean, it's actually the fossil fuel industry who started the campaign to clean up beaches. Now, we do need to clean up the beaches, but it directs the focus on cleaning up the mess, but not turning off the mess at the source. So as a communicator in interviewing all these experts, I've learned that actually one of the biggest things we can then do as consumers, as citizens, to help the environment is to make our voices heard and say, you guys are the problem and you need to stop. So it means speaking to your representative in parliament, but it also means one of the most powerful things we can still do as consumers actually is making sure that all the electricity that everybody's family uses, who've kindly asked questions today, is all renewable, like 100% renewable, and asking our parents, and as you get older, putting your money in banks that you know don't invest in fossil fuels or damaging industries like mining. That sends a very clear message. and hurts those industries where it matters most, which is profit, profit, profit. That's what they prioritize above the planet. So it's a slightly more convoluted answer, but that's where I've learned is the most effective way is to make your voices heard. And where it really matters is where you put your money. And that means not funding more fossil fuel extraction by putting your money in a bank that actually does still fund that.
That's a brilliant answer. It's one of the first times I've asked that question and someone hasn't responded with like an individual action, and you actually like change the responsibility to the bigger companies, which is so
lovely. Well, and you know, I used to say, I do a lot of talks around this subject, and there was a whole list of things that we can all do. And then I had that and I went, but what I'm learning from experts is actually the biggest contributors to the problem are these people. And now I've kind of gotten rid of the first slide that talks about what we can do. Don't get me wrong, we absolutely have to keep doing those things, but we also have to realistically know that we can't tie ourselves in knots by not doing anything that's going to damage the planet, because by miles and miles, that's not going to make that much of a difference if those industries continue to do what they do. And, you know, I have no problem telling people, take your holiday. Don't feel guilty about getting on one plane when billionaires are flying in their jets. And when you compare how much they contribute to climate change with the jets they use in a week compared to what one person will do in a year by taking one holiday, it doesn't even compare. And I think those types of messages need to be spread more.
Of course. What Planet Are We On was a brilliant podcast, which I wish continued. How did you find discussing the climate crisis and sharing your fears with the guests you had? Was it helpful or did it leave you feeling sad?
It was really, really helpful. And it was another example for me, or a bit of a light bulb moment that made me realize that when we feel afraid, when we feel anxious about what's ahead, the most powerful thing we can do is connect to other people and speak about solutions together. And work as a community towards solutions, right? So I found it amazing. And also the people that we were interviewing, from David Attenborough to Cristiana Figueres, who was really important in the Paris Agreement, the climate change Paris Agreement. I mean, she led that negotiation, an incredible woman. When you speak to people like that, like world leaders who are the best example of humanity, you get really inspired and you feel much more positive about what's ahead. As much as we were delving into some pretty difficult subjects, again, it's not about ignoring it. The truth is, it's happening anyway. So how are you going to help to be a part of the change and take care of yourself through it? Well, two of the most important things are connect to nature, sit under a tree. Even just doing that really helps, you know, your mood and your mental health. And connect to people. Connect to people, talk, feel supported. That's what I do a lot in my job, and that's why I can continue doing what I do. Yeah. So I loved making that podcast. It was great fun.
Good. Okay. Am I right in thinking that rivers and waterways seem to have fascinated you in recent years? What draws you to them and why is their story so important?
I mean, the water has always fascinated me. I was a water baby. I was, you know, in the ocean, I don't know, from a year old, you know, I love the water. And in recent years, coming from the UK, unfortunately, we've had a funny old time realizing just how bad our rivers and waterways have become, because for decades, the private water companies were taking all our bill money, but they weren't paying for upkeep of the infrastructure. And so that was building up and building up and building up. You know, the infrastructure was getting older and older and weaker. And then suddenly a few years ago, we had human sewage and agricultural runoff with really toxic chemicals and animal sewage flowing down these rivers in the so-called sixth most powerful country in the world, right? Like, it's, where are we living? You know, in the world, are we in the Middle Ages? So as a biologist, as a communicator, suddenly, you know, yes, journalistically, we turn our attention to that and we start investigating what's going on. It was another example of just how the way we live in the global north prioritizes profits above taking care of each other and the planet that we absolutely need in order to survive. And at the same time with the BBC, we were filming a beautiful story about indigenous people in Northern California who had been fighting for the restoration of a huge river called the Klamath, where four big hydroelectric dams had been built. And after 100 years of campaigning, they got them taken down. During those 100 years when the dams were up, the river was dying. It was toxic. There was all these algal blooms building up and the salmon couldn't do their runs. And all around, the landscape around it was suffering, because if you don't have a healthy river, the landscape around it is affected, right? It's a whole ecosystem-wide issue. And so once the dams came down and I went and met them and we were replanting native plants on the exposed riverbeds of the old reservoirs, and it was a really inspiring experience to speak to those communities who completely fundamentally understand that we need to take care of nature so it can take care of us, and for them to have won that case and to play a role in bringing their beautiful beloved spiritual river back to life, and to hear them talk about why it's important and what they were going to do to get it back to health was hugely inspiring. So I've learned a lot from those two examples. Yeah, there's still quite a lot of work to do with our rivers here in Great Britain, unfortunately. Yeah.
Sure.
So you recently made an amazing documentary podcast series that might be a hard listen for some of our listeners. But Dead River is an amazing piece of work. It talks about the damage inflicted by mining in Brazil. While the content is really hard to hear, one takeaway from it was the harmony with nature that seemed to be inbuilt for Indigenous people for centuries. I think we've moved way too far in the wrong direction. So, can I ask, what do you think we need to do to find that balance again?
That's a beautiful question. And you described the podcast really well. And yes, it is a hard listen in parts. It's been an interesting time for me to inadvertently work with more and more Indigenous people and find out more and more about Indigenous knowledge. And as a biologist who was trained in the West about how to take care of nature, our science is magnificent. It's allowed us to do incredible things and to achieve great things in protecting nature. But what I've learned is that the Indigenous way of looking at the planet is very, very different, but it is as valid and as valuable and as important a knowledge system. In fact, it is absolutely another science. It just has different methodologies. And so with the Klamath River story I just mentioned, but then with the Dead River podcast, I began to learn more and more about that connection that some Indigenous communities, you could say, never lost, right? For all of their generations, since time immemorial is how they describe it, they have known that they are nature and they have known to coexist with it and to take only what they need and to always ask for permission from Mother Nature. And it's beautiful, that relationship. And it teaches you a lot about being reciprocal and taking care of things in a way that we've forgotten in the West. And as a conservationist, I also know that the approach to taking care of nature is much more holistic. They see it landscape-wise. It's not just about a tree or a species or even a small area. It's about the whole landscape, and that it's all in balance. Over billions of years, everything around you has evolved to carry out a role in delicate balance with everything else. So if you come in and you just mess up one aspect of it, everything is going to collapse. And they just know that. They just know that. I'm not going to say instinctively, because it's way more than that. They know that because that knowledge, that experience of living in this environment has been passed down the generations. They always have rituals and ceremonies, and the elders speak to the children and they pass on this knowledge, and every generation builds on that knowledge. So it's a much richer, it's a much deeper knowledge system than ours. And that's what I learned about those communities who were devastated by this mining accident, where, again, a big mining company didn't care about the people. They just cared about the money. So they didn't take care of the mine. And there was an accident that destroyed, you know, the whole river and lots of livelihoods and lots of Indigenous ways of life. So, gosh, you know, that podcast was a real stark example of, like, we humans can be horrendous. We don't even care about each other, never mind the planet. But look at us. We can be amazing. Look at these Indigenous communities and how they live and what they value. And I, as a communicator, I'm so passionate about telling more of those stories, because I think it will help us all to remember how to be human, how to be really like what the best of who we are. Because at our core, we are lovely. It's just that along the way, some of us might have forgotten that we are lovely.
We need to dig back into those roots, and we definitely have so much to learn from those people.
We do.
Will asks,
what is affecting climate crisis the most and why?
Great question, Will. And again, it's probably not as expected an answer as you might have imagined, but it's based on what I've learned. I'm not even going to say that it's a particular industry, although it's categorically the fossil fuel industry, okay? So that is the biggest cause of climate change. That's what's affecting climate change the most. But actually, what I think is really important for us all to understand is it's not so much that an industry, it's the way we live, it's our system. And by that, as a biologist, I had to start learning about economics, and that's not how my brain works. I've got a science brain. I stay in my lane. But just like we've been talking about interconnectivity and things are all connected, this is true for this too. The reason why we are damaging our planet is because we live in a world in the global north where we prioritize profits, infinite profit, endless growth above taking care of the planet, which is literally our life support system. You know, over billions of years, all the species on the planet evolved and worked intimately interconnected with each other to create beautiful forests and beautiful ocean ecosystems to make this planet habitable for us. It's the only reason we're here is because nature, in synchrony and in balance, allows us to breathe air, drink clean water, and to be alive and to grow food. The way we've decided to live in the global north, decided success looks like making more and more and more and more and more and more money endlessly. There's no limit. And taking resources out of the planet endlessly. David Attenborough said something very cool once in an interview. He said, how can you have infinite growth on a planet with finite resources? Like, it's crazy. It doesn't make any sense. And so what I'm trying to, I guess, explain is that we need to transform what we prioritize, and then we're going to be absolutely fine. So we can have some profit, we can have a thriving economy and a thriving society, but we absolutely must make sure the planet is taken care of with all the decisions we make. How we make something, how we throw something away, is that damaging the planet? Okay, we'll do it a different way. And if we transform that way of thinking, anything is possible and we can live an amazing future. And really quickly, I will mention that there are these economists who are now called ecological economists who are working towards that. So already there are amazing experts going, yep, we've got this. We can do this in a different way.
That's really, really good. So one final question, and it's one that I'd like to know too. Robin asks,
how do you hope the world looks like in 50 years' time?
That's a lovely question, Robin. In 50 years' time, I would like to see the world where people have reconnected to nature and to each other and to community. And we have a political system and an economic system where we can succeed and we can be ambitious, but not at the cost of the planet. So we found a way, thanks to these ecological economists and these environmental lawyers, to make sure that we have this beautiful, thriving world where nature is at the very heart of it. We protect it, we nurture it, we give back to it so it can give back to us, and we live in harmony again. We all used to live in harmony with nature. We were all indigenous once. Back in the day, humans were very much more connected to nature. So I'd love to see that. Of course, it's the modern world, right? So we're using technology and we're going to have transport. We're not going to stop some of the great advances, but whatever we do, nature's there, nature's here. In how we do life. And it's not that big a dream, because I know from experts that it is completely possible. We can achieve this if we all work together. And I can see it in my mind's eyes. And there's trees everywhere in all the cities. I saw an image of Oxford Street is the big shopping center street in London, where they're looking to do a plan where they're just going to fill it with trees. It's going to be pedestrianized, and there's going to be trees the whole way along it. You know, I can see around the world, whether you're in a city or in the countryside, it's green, pollinators are encouraged. You know, we are living properly in harmony with nature because we are nature. That's what I'd love to see in 50 years' time.
That's so beautiful. And on behalf of like all the questions and all the people that asked you your questions, all of it was so inspiring, especially as someone who might, I'm still trying to figure it out, but I might possibly go into, you know, a media career, maybe, we'll see.
Do it. We need beautiful communicators like yourself. Let's do this. Please thank all of them for me. I loved the questions and I loved chatting to you. Thank you for having me.
No, thank you so much. We can't thank you enough. From those listening, what can we look forward to next from you?
Well, I have a new project starting with the BBC, but I actually can't really speak about it. But I can say that it's going to be about the planet. And it's going to be about how everything is interconnected. And that's what creates this beautiful, living, breathing majesty of a system that we are all lucky enough to be on. And then I'm also working on a project with National Geographic Society, which is about Indigenous wisdom and Western scientists who are working with Indigenous knowledge holders to do better science. So they're my two projects coming up.
Very mysterious. I'll be looking out for them. Lastly, do you have a final message for our audience?
My final message would be that if ever you feel a little bit worried about what's ahead, know that there are amazing humans everywhere doing much more than we hear about in the news. And also know that the best cure for feeling more positive about the future is to connect to people. Get off your tablets, get off your phones, even for a little bit, and go outside and play with your friends, chat to your friends and your family, and make sure you connect to nature every day, and you'll feel a whole lot better.
Ecolution is produced by Nikki Coughlin with production assistance from Aoife O'Neill, and is presented by me, Evie Kelly.
RTE Junior Podcast! For more sort of RTE Kids Podcasts!